Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly lightning meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polysbon, and I'm joined today by Nicolas Sarian, Zohar Atkins, and Harry Jacobs. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good to be here.
Hey.
Harry, would you do us the honor of reading today's quote?
I will, absolutely. With the exception of the instinct of self-preservation, the propensity for emulation is probably the strongest and most alert and persistent of the economic motives proper. Thorstein Veblen, Theory of the Leisure Class.
Awesome.
Powerful.
So besides the instinct of self-preservation, emulation is the strongest, most persistent motivation. He's talking about economics here specifically.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Harry?
What do you think, Harry?
I think there are a couple of different ways that we can look at it. We can look at it from the philosophical perspective. And I know that we'll hear from you, Nico, and Zohar about the deeper meaning behind it. But the initial thought I have was to dumb it down beyond the instinct for fight or flight. It's, as the kids would say, it's about how to make that cheddar, right? It's about how to find success financially. And my big question, my takeaway from this, beyond whatever input both of you are going to have from a philosophy perspective, is have we created a generation of people that are emulating the wrong things? I realize I could probably sound like the get off my lawn guy when I say that, but is being a TikToker something to emulate? Is being an Instagram influencer something to emulate?
That reminds me, Harry, of a famous, very famous moment in Don DeLillo's novel White Noise, one of the great postmodern novelists, where there's a sign on the side of the highway that people get out of their cars to go pay homage to. They go make a pilgrimage to the sign. And the sign says on itself, this is the most visited sign. What makes it desirable is the fact that it's desirable. It has no content, no intrinsic value. It just managed to capture value from the fact that others value it. So I think that does hit on the point of emulation, which is we don't necessarily know why we emulate what we do, but once we start emulating, there's no exit from it.
And there's no guidance, right? Sometimes we can emulate the right things and know that we're on the right path, but what about people that emulate the wrong things? Or maybe something that isn't real or sustainable, or I guess it's on us to figure it out. To me, it just opens up a whole can of worms about Instagram and TikTok and influencers and the young people that may be watching this, or the parents of young kids. Like, it's powerful.
There's self-preservation, which is the survival of the body. And then the question of emulation, whether you're emulating the right things or the wrong things, concerns what Aristotle would call flourishing, or if you will, like the survival or the maintenance of the soul. Not to be overly dualistic, but I think that's how I would think about it. Is obviously, there's no discussion to be had about emulation unless you're doing self-preservation first. If you're not self-preserving, there's nothing to talk about. But once you've done the self-preservation, then we can get into the next level in Maslow's hierarchy. And that's why you find often that in Western modernized countries where the self-preservation is taken for care of, most people survive infancy thanks to breakthroughs in medicine and so forth. We don't have no running water in most places, like the life conditions in sort of America compared to other places are far higher. But then that's why you also then get the cultural problems, because it's like where people almost get bored. Like, where do you focus your energy if you don't have to focus it on self-preservation?
And self-preservation happens in so many ways almost all day long, right? At different times for people, right? We do things to make sure that we're going to be okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm reading this quote and it says economic motives. So I instantly thought of market crashes and just panic selling when I read this, and just watching how most traders and Wall Street just follow the strongest trend in the moment.
This so emulation drives the market.
So this was written by, and this was written by Thorstein Veblen. He was American, wasn't he? Let me I can actually check the promotion page.
Yeah, he was
Norwegian.
Norwegian
American. Yeah.
Can we get a little bit of
look at GameStop? Right.
He died in 1929, the same year as the Great Depression.
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, I was rereading this text recently, Theory of the Leisure Class. Zohar made a mention of Veblen a few episodes back when he talked about what is considered to be a Veblen good or Veblen pricing. This is actually something that Veblen doesn't talk about in his book, but there's this idea that was extracted from Veblen's theory, which states that certain types of goods that are called Veblen goods are generative of demand by the increase in price and not by some sort of equilibrium between supply and demand. So the idea being that people value certain things just because they're expensive. And the more expensive they are, the more value they have.
I think that's true formally, but doesn't descriptively or phenomenologically capture why that is the case. Because you can't just raise your prices on anything and have that be the case. It's only on premium goods. If I charge double for an airline ticket in economy, no one's, that's awesome. Here's the price of my ticket. I'm double your status because you paid half. It only works for some people pay $15 for a bottle of spring water or whatever for certain things. And so the question is like, why are those things? Why are you able to pay a premium for those things, but not for other things? Why are some things prone to fluctuations in status where the status is obvious? And in other areas, there's no status gain from doing it. So I think it has to do with functionality. Things whose value consists in their self-preservation, you're not going to pay a premium for self-preservation. What you're paying a premium for is the desire to be, you're paying a premium for something that will make others want to emulate you.
And we have this new way of putting a value on things. I was just triggered by what Cyrus did with holding up the bottle of Pellegrino or whatever.
And I'll do it again.
It's fine. So my point is that we have this generation of people that are influencers. People watching the podcast see that Cyrus is drinking this drink, increasing artificially or not. No offense to Cyrus, but my point is that we've got a different way of valuing things these days than we did.
San Pellegrino is really delicious. I'm not going to lie. And they didn't just pay me to say that.
Me hand you one, Zohar.
Sparkling water.
That'd be so great if you just pulled one out.
I mean, think about the difference between still water and sparkling water. Still water is whatever. You can tie that to utility, self-preservation, the fact of being hydrated. What about sparkling? What are the sparkles doing for you there?
It's the taste, isn't it?
Is this a different taste?
It gives you that nice belch. It helps clear you out.
Listen, it's a soda substitute because I would drink Diet Coke all day long. So if I have one of those, it's a way to get the bubbles. It's a way to get that soda thing without the...
Yeah.
I do think like there's some comedic ads to be made. Moses striking the rock and water coming up. People complaining in the desert, like, where's our water? And out comes some seltzer, right? I do think that it hits home the point that there's a difference between base need and this meta need for recognition or pride or megalomania even.
Yeah, no, I think I think the sparkling water is a great example because functionally it serves no other need or purpose, really. But Nico, actually, you brought up a good point. But oftentimes I've noticed when going to a nicer restaurant, maybe in Europe or in, let's say, Corona Del Mar in California or something, as soon as one person orders sparkling water, most of the table will be like, oh, yeah, I'll take sparkling as well.
It's
emulating you for taking the sparkling water.
Exactly.
It's interesting because Veblen doesn't say the propensity for cultivating emulation, but rather the propensity for emulation. Most people don't want to be the first, right? By definition, they want to be the second or the third or the fourth. Let somebody else take the risk of being the first to order the Pellegrino. Okay, now that it's safe, tribe leader, I'll have one too. So it almost feels like the emulation is maybe attached to belonging or fitting in, whereas the thing that's unanswered by this question is what accounts for trendsetters? Like, why are there people who do not wait to emulate, but rather cause emulation or provoke emulation?
I think it's the first reason is the reason that people don't want to be the first to emulate then. It's the instinct of self-preservation. Like you said in a previous episode, everyone wants to be contrarian, but no one wants to be contrarian and wrong. I guess it's the people who have that messed up. They have it mixed up for whatever reason. They're like, no, yeah, I'm willing. That self-preservation drive is lower. They're like, yeah, I'll take the risk. I'll wear that ridiculous hat.
Emulation or keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But,
right, but I think that you can boil this down to a polarity between supply and demand, like in pure economic terms, because one of the things that Veblen focuses on that not a lot of economists previously did was look at consumption, look at the economy from the side of consumption and not from the side of production, which is like what classical political economy does, like Smith and others. And production, in a sense, is tied to necessity, to the fact that there are, call it sacred cows, that, or axiomatic principles that, let's say, there's a few things necessity needs that have to be covered, and those things are untouchable. And production is tied to solving problems, solving inefficiencies, these sorts of things. On the other hand, there's this other idea where, well, this is a bit more radical than Veblen, and it actually comes later in some French thinkers, where you say, but who is saying, or how do you establish self-preservation and needs? Who says you have to eat three times a day, like the three meals? Like, where does that come from, no? Who says, like, that, how do you get to caloric regimes, no? That we need X amount of calories per day to be healthy and whatnot. And that's, I think, what points to slightly to what Zohar is asking, is how do you establish the value of what is useful and necessary? In purely economic terms, like that you need X amount of calories to survive or to just, I don't know, not die or dehydrate or whatever.
People die of and loneliness and depression and anxiety and all these sort of mushy things that people go to therapy for. I shouldn't say mushy because there is a chemical basis for them. But you understand the point that there are deaths of despair and actions that people take that correspond to mood states. And with that in mind, self-preservation is a broad category that might even overlap with emulation, meaning a person who has low self-esteem and suffers from that might benefit from feeling more connected to community, even if those bonds are somewhat artificial, even if they're based in emulation. And so you could argue, if I play the devil's advocate, that emulation is an extension of self-preservation, and that one of the reasons why people in modern atomized society are suffering so much loneliness is actually because they've lost the ability to know who they're supposed to emulate. They don't actually see role models in person or belong to one community in person where they know where there's a sort of chain of not chain of command, but like hierarchy of status. So let's say you grew up in a French village in 1200, maybe you aspire to be the priest of that village or the merchant of that village, or perhaps just a successful parent or something like this. But you know what the archetypes of success are, and there's a limited supply of them. And you either hit it or you don't, but you're on a path. Whereas today, there's almost so many different models to choose from and no real intimacy that you have with anyone in your neighborhood or in your physical community. That's why people turn to the internet and aspire to be internet influencers. It's almost in lieu of having a different model.
And you have people like, I'm going to use Joe Rogan as an example. I'm a UFC fan. I'm a fan of his comedy. I happen to enjoy what he does and what he says. He's one of those guys to me, like John Madden. I could have listened to John Madden read the phone book and I would have found it fascinating. Right. But my issue with Rogan is that he blows hot and cold with the wind. He appears at times to me to be a chameleon of sorts. right? In that he will have an opinion on something on a podcast, and then a week later he'll have a guest on and he blows hot and cold. If he's got an issue with it, he won't necessarily bring it up, or he'll go to the other side and won't think always for as much as he thinks for himself. I find him blowing hot and cold, and people do that, right? People emulate, they don't know what to emulate. So they find this one person that they emulate, and then they find someone else. And ultimately these can be dangerous people in our lives that are emulating the wrong things if we allow them to be that.
Joe Rogan is an excellent podcast host for that reason. I think as an interviewer, you need to get your subject comfortable. And that's the ultimate goal. So he's in his mind, and you do it in acting as well. You might play a character with a belief different than yours, but you allow enough empathy in your head to see, okay, where are they coming from? And I'm going to understand that. And just, it's like talking through someone who's upset about something that's irrational, and you know all that you're clearly in the wrong, or it's not that big a deal or whatever. But you don't say that. You say, yeah, that just sucks, huh? It's that surrender of judgment that suspension of judgment that I think that same thing that he's employing. And that's why it seems he blows hot and cold all the time, because he's just not objecting a lot of times to what his guests are saying. And he needs to, because his self-preservation depends on his emulation. Those two are the same for him.
He's also the first to say, I have FU money and I can do what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're totally right about like just everyday life. If someone's doing that's a big.
Like, yeah.
The thing is with the FU money, I can't believe I'm saying this. Gary, you brought it out of me. What you really need is not money. It's psychological stability. And you can give a person $1 billion. And that's not enough FU money for them, because they have a desire to be liked that they've got hardwired into them from either nature or nurture. And the question is, what drives a person to desire to be liked so much that they could put their own truth to the side, or their own opinion to the side, because they want to be brought into the fold, brought into the community? I think it's an evolutionary fear. Fear that if you stand out, you're not going to survive. And so that fear does have a rational basis. But the point is that even if you're safe now, a lot of people don't feel safe, even if they are. You could have $1 billion and still keep it in a suitcase under your mattress, so to say. So I think that's what's going on. Even Warren Buffett talks about his one of his core motivations in life. You would think it's to make money, given that he's made so much of it. But he says, no, it's he desires applause. The thing that motivates him is going to his annual meeting and seeing all the shareholders, and they clap for him. And they tell him, wow, Warren, you did such a good job. You made us all this money. That's what gets him out of bed. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think like it is in some ways other-centric to want the crowd's applause, but it's a little bit self-centered as well, because you're almost like needing that validation for your own sense of self-worth.
And he's doing for people the opposite of what he does for himself, when you think about it, right? He drives a hoopty. He drives a car that's, you know, I don't know what he's driving now, but he's, you know, Toyota Corolla, used 10-year-old car. He's, you know, he's not big into money or living in some elaborate and lavish way, but he goes to these meetings where he's made people millionaires or multimillionaires, and he's taking that praise for something that's really unimportant to him. It's more important. I don't know what's most important to Warren Buffett, but in a sense, there's this kind of dichotomy about what he's doing, right? How he lives and how he values money, what he does with his money.
I see consistency between it all, because it is the ethic of frugality is related to being a good investor. It's saying, make sure that the dollar you spend gets the highest possible return. So why spend, actually maps onto the Veblen point, why spend a dollar on the Lambo when a dollar spent on the Toyota Corolla will do the job just fine? And why invest in a company that, like, don't praise the company that raises a lot of money and spends a lot of money. Praise the company that that spends the least amount of money and raises the least amount of money and nonetheless achieves the same result. I think that being a good investor and being good at spending money are completely different character traits. But actually, to your point, Harry, so Buffett was a student, part of the intellectual lineage of Ben Graham. Benjamin Graham was the OG value investor, and he popularized the concept of, since you're smoking a cigar, Harry, cigar butts, meaning find companies that are super cheap and undervalued and buy them and make a little bit of money buying these undervalued companies that are really cheap. And that was Warren Buffett's approach to investing until Charlie Munger, his business partner, gave him a different philosophy, imparted to him a different philosophy. And that is the idea of paying a reasonable price for a good company. So Buffett changed from trying to get good deals on like bad companies, basically. That was the original meaning of value investing, to a more expansive view of value investing, where value can be defined as get a good company at a decent price. And the insight there being that if you get something at a fair price, but it's good, then over time, it will still prove to give you a lot of value. So you don't have to go the cheap route. Right. And so that would be the counter to like why you're buying the Toyota Corolla is, hey, maybe buying a really good car at a fair price is still a better investment than buying a really cheap car just to prove how frugal you are.
Just buy the Range Rover, Warren.
Yeah. So example, by the way, is Apple versus Amazon, and Apple being a design company that invested heavily in aesthetics. And so their products are more expensive. And the idea of Apple being that you should pay a premium for that sort of elegance and that beauty, as opposed to Amazon, which really emphasized efficiency and frugality. For whatever reason, Buffett passed on Amazon, but he did manage to put an investment in Apple that now to date is his best one. So he probably wouldn't have done the Apple investment without Munger. And the story about it goes that because Buffett claims not to know much about technology and not to want to invest in technology companies, but somebody like was really upset that they lost their iPhone at his house. And is anyone that feels that way about a product, like the product's probably good, so I should invest in it.
That's an interesting perspective. There was a line I just got through reading 0 to 1, which I highly recommend to anyone thinking about getting into business or anyone that is in business to look at things in a different way. But there's a part in that that discusses this issue with Apple. And they say, essentially paraphrasing, anyone that's ever held an Apple device knows that it not only that it operates differently, it just feels and looks differently, right, than anything else. Those, to me, I'm an Apple guy. So the Droid devices are confusing and don't do anything for me. They're not aesthetically pleasing.
No offense to Android users, but it's just disgusting to hold an Android.
Hey, let's see. What are the market caps right now of Microsoft and Apple?
It's top five.
So Microsoft is worth $3.1 trillion and Apple is 2.6. So that's interesting. But whatever. You can't
make it always goes back and forth.
Yeah. They're both big, so whatever. Yeah. But I associate Microsoft with self-preservation and Apple with emulation is the point I was going to make, which is to say whether you like Microsoft or not, you just need a Microsoft's products. You don't really need Apple's products other than everybody that has a Mac and AirPods or an iPad or whatever. So you should probably get one. And then once you do, okay, you're not going to switch. You're not going to switch. They make it hard to leave. But.
And they dictate terms, right? I'm a music guy. I've been a music nut my entire life. There are songs and there are artists that are the fabric of my life. I went to Bruce Springsteen on Friday night here in Vegas. And so many of those songs are the could be the soundtrack of my life. But I can't take the music collection that I have and put it on my Apple phone with iTunes anymore. I can't. You're either because the way that Apple has changed iTunes is that you either subscribe to iTunes or you put your own music on the phone. Mm. And
what about Spotify?
I can do Spotify, but it's new and I'm the get off my lawn guy.
Nico, be patient with the boomer.
I'm the Buffett BP. Oh, here we go.
I mean,
Spotify is old enough.
I started
like downloading music through Napster, you know, when I was eight. We're on the same frequency here. It's just, I don't know. It's like you go from Napster to Line to, I don't know, just like using torrents.
So much of my music came from Napster that I have in my computer.
That's my way to pitch Alexandria is Napster for the classics.
Where's Metallica? That's my question.
Right.
Harry, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Which Bruce Springsteen song do you think most accurately maps onto this quote from Veblen, top of mind or top of heart?
Born in the USA. Easy.
Here's the thing about that. Here's what I'll say about that. I'll say the same thing to anyone that feels that Born in the USA is a patriotic song, because they remember in 1984 when he came out and put the biggest record of his career out, and it was this anthem, and he was big and buff at that point, and everything was red, white, and blue, and the banner in his back, the red bandana and the blue jeans and the white t-shirt, it was all red, white, and blue. But Born in the USA is the most anti-American song that there could possibly be, because it's about a veteran who
gives everything. Yeah.
Loses everything when he comes home. It makes me emotional to think about what veterans lay down for this country. And that song is about someone who came home and got screwed. And so to me, it's not Born in the USA, right? This quote, it could be Thunder Road. Right. It's a town full of losers and I'm pulling out of here to win. I'm going to find my way. I'm going to protect myself. And then I'm going to create what I need to create. There are a number of those songs, but to me, it's Thunder Road.
What was your first concert like, live music?
My first big concert was Styx at the Boston Garden in, I think, 1981. And there's nothing profound about Styx, but it wasn't that. But I've seen Springsteen 31 or 32 times.
Wow.
And I met him once, and it was the most, and politically I sit on the far opposite, polar opposite of where he sits, but there's so much about his life and what he does that meeting him to me was one of the most unbelievable and surreal things. And for most artists, when you go meet them at a concert, what happens is they put you in a meeting room in an arena and they put you up against the wall, or they put you in a group and then they escort the artist in and they walk the artist around to say hello to everybody. I've done a million of those from working in radio. With Bruce, what they do is they walk into that big meeting room and they look at the group of people and they go, okay, Cyrus, Nico, Zohar, Harry, you four come with me. And they bring you to a room to meet Bruce, so that Bruce can be present with you. And for me, when I walked in that room, it was like Thunder Road in my head, be able to have an audience with him. And I was a kid in a candy store. I did what I do on this podcast. As much as I can get out, I get out. But if there were 25 questions asked between the four people that were in there, I asked 22 of them. And at the end, when it was over, the rep from Columbia and his assistant said, you wait for 1 second. They let the three other people go. And the rep said, he liked you. He'll sign something for you or take a picture. Do you have a phone or something for him to sign? And there was this big deal about bringing stuff to him to do that with. And I said, I have this set list that I stole from the sound man that's handwritten by Bruce. And I said, would you sign? And I took it out of my pocket. I said, would you sign this?
And like, where'd you get that?
It's two rows of 35 songs. We played for 3 hours. And he said, I didn't leave myself any room to sign. I said, sign it wherever you want. Sign it sideways, sign it on the back, do whatever you want to do. But to me, I look at what he did as a kid growing up in Freehold and who he emulated, right? I look at the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and a kid that was so enamored with the guitar that he picked it up. And he talks about this, and he couldn't make any sound out of it in the beginning when it cost the family at that time a lot of money. But he turned that into the most unbelievable thing, an unbelievable career. And he's touched so many people. And he will be the first to admit, I make grown men cry with what I do. And that was the case on Friday night, listening to him play Thunder Road or Racing in the Streets, or that to me is something to emulate.
So it's a town full of losers. I'm pulling out here to win. To me, that line seems to go against emulation. Or I guess actually it's complicated, but it depends on who you're emulating, right? Are you emulating losers or are you emulating heroes, demigods? And I think pulling out to win suggests that you actually have to quit the bad habit of peer pressure, or at least swap out your peers. I think it's actually ambiguous, right? Is it saying get out of town and go somewhere else where you can emulate a different group? Or is it saying don't emulate? You mentioned 0-1. Thiel has this incredible line, competition is for losers. So when you graph that line onto I'm pulling out here to win, it's saying don't compete. Don't be in a position where you're trying to be marginally better than somebody else. That whole game is a losing game, even when you win the game. What you really want to be doing is singing your own song, being an original, being a genius. But of course, how many can be Bruce Springsteen? Or how many can be a successful genius? And even Bruce Springsteen, you mentioned his influences, he's still emulating someone, right? There's still a playbook that you have to follow. How do I type it into ChatGPT? I would like to be an original genius and make a career out of that, doing the thing that I most love doing and singing the song in my heart and getting thousands of people to come out to my concerts or whatever, read my books. Please tell me the step by step. And of course, everybody's typing that in. There's only so many that can actually do it.
There's Springsteen will be the first to admit we can't all be Elvis Costello, right? Or we can't be Bob Dylan. And those are people that he emulated. He emulated the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and pop music on one side, but to be able to write in the profound way that he wrote about. And then if you go see the Broadway show, you would have heard him say, listen, I have made a career out of talking about cars and working in factories and being the everyman. And he said, the whole thing is built on a lie. I never worked an honest day in my life until I did the Broadway show and had to work 5 days a week. And I hate it. And he didn't drive until he was 19 or 20 years old. And he wrote about all these cars racing in the streets and fighting in the streets and jungle land and all this stuff. But to some degree, it was almost a dream in his mind what he created. Those songs, he didn't necessarily live. They lived in his mind.
Do you guys know who Felix Dennis is? Look him up. He wrote a book. He wrote a lot of books, including one called How to Get Rich, which is his memoir. But he was an unsuccessful musician hippie who then became a successful publishing entrepreneur in the UK and became like mega rich, and then basically became a poet and wrote and a drug addict and then wrote about how he wished that he could go back and devote his life to writing poetry and gardening and not being in business. But I mentioned him because he got career advice from John Lennon, I believe, at a party when he was trying to become a musician. And Lennon was like, you're never going to make it because you emulate too much. There's not an original note in your soul. Like, all you're trying to do is take a bunch of other things and mix and match it. And it's just like, all right, fine, I'll be an entrepreneur. So it's interesting, like, also when you think about that as it relates to AI, as not having an original bone in its body and just like mixing and matching. So I think that it's, how do you find the right balance between having influences, productive influences, but still maintaining your distinction? So it's, I don't have to be Elvis Costello or Bob Dylan, I just have to be Zohar. But then also having the self-realization to know when you're not going to make it as well.
Yeah. It's interesting that Thorstein did say, he didn't say it was the best trait. He's not making a judgment call on emulation. He's just saying it's the strongest, most alert and persistent of the economic motives proper. And correct me if I'm interpreting this older English incorrectly, but proper meaning most, right? That's what it means. He's saying the average.
With the exception of the instinct of self-preservation.
Economic motive.
Proper is related to property. It's basically an economic motive versus an economic motive proper. The difference is an economic motive proper means it's fundamentally and at its core related to the economic motives, as opposed to just tangentially so.
I see. Okay. But the first point remains that he's making no judgment call on its...
Yeah, we jumped immediately in the conversation to like, how do you know if you're emulating the right things and why are we, kids these days,
yeah,
the wrong influences? Whereas Veblen is formally neutral. He's just saying, look, this is how the economy works. I'll say it very plain. GDP can be broken into two baskets. Things which people need for self-preservation and things which people need for status. And that's the big light bulb moment is, wow, when you actually think about US GDP or global GDP, what percentage is attributable to self-preservation versus status? And you could argue that like 80 or 90% is actually status related. So that's the radical point, is that when you actually analyze your budget and think about what percentage of your budget is going, even just do it at the micro household level, is going to, I want to look cool to other people or to myself. I want to be desirable by buying the right clothes, listening to the right music, etc. Most of it is going to status and not to self-preservation.
I have a problem with this because, and this is just because of, I don't know, the research or the work that I have done, which is, how do you define what self-preservation is?
Yeah.
You know? Because I'm pretty sure if you, this can be like a multicultural problem, because self-preservation in one, like you look at the, call it caloric regime of certain people in certain countries, totally different from somewhere else, elsewhere in the world, or even historically. So the what you're talking about is like the difference between what we call needs and wants, no?
Sure.
Wants is like superfluous.
Many manage what they can never self-preserve.
Right. Yes. Right. I'll put you there. I'll put you in that situation. That's my... So there's an anthropologist called Marshall Salins, who I think he's still alive, famous guy from the University of Chicago. He wrote an anthology of his essays called Stone Age Economics. And one of the essays there is called The Original Affluent Society, which is a study on the caloric regimes of hunter and gatherer societies. And one interesting thing that he says there is that we know since, let's say, the age of social contract thinking, since the age of Hobbes, no, where you would have two models. Man in nature, primitive man, or whatever you want to call it, is either poor, and this is the conditions suck, and this is like the Hobbes. It's more complicated than Hobbes, but nonetheless, let's take it like as it is. Or you have this kind of Rousseau, the noble savage in nature, romantic, everything is good. So there's those two things. The thing that Salin says is that there is no concept of property, of possessing, of, let's say, because what constitutes a person being poor or rich, what, like, the amount of things he has, no? There is no conception of property in the way that we understand it, say, back in the day, back, let's say, I don't know, 3,000 years, when we had hunter and gatherer societies, because they were nomadic. They didn't possess anything. They would just move with what they could take with themselves. And what he says is, and this is fascinating, because I think, under my regard, like, this is the core definition of what we consider wealth. He says, wealth, in small, short parentheses, if you look at the etymologies of the terms that we use for wealth, it points back to this. Wealth is tied to mobility. The fact that you can, let's say, move around things. Liquidity is a similar concept. The fact that you can churn things around quickly. You can take things with you and just change locations. The main point being that.
So why do people buy houses then? So to say, it feels like the regime is. Because at least for the past 50 plus years, like, the goal that most people have, middle class people, is I'm going to buy a home, and then that's a real asset, and now I've made it, so to say. And I'm going to find a partner and settle down and have 2.5 kids with a white picket fence and a dog. So how do we go from
an accretion of assets?
This goes back a little bit to the Taleb discussion. find, you know, given ceteris paribus, no, like the economist, like this term, like all the variables are the same. So like buying a house is a good investment. But if you take, if you try and assess expenditure or invest or an investment, no, historically through with duration throughout time, the most efficient or valuable storage of wealth, or let's say unit of value, is the most liquid one. Cash, no, gold, property is not liquid enough. So if you're trying to reduce risk and contingency for the ages, I would like to have something that I can, say, sell at any time now in 40 years. This is what everybody's trying to do, I think. Unless you're an idiot, I would say.
Maybe the problem with cash is that it suggests insecurity, because you're signaling that you need to be able to move on a dime's notice. Whereas it's a flex to have a house, an illiquid house, that would, you put it on Zillow and it's there for 700 days with no offers because it's so niche. You know what I mean? Yeah. Every room is designed differently. That's the flex, because it means, hey, I can hold this. I'm stable enough that I don't think that there's going to be a famine or a war tomorrow and I'm going to have to get up and abandon it.
Yes, but the house doesn't, but the house in that duration does not appreciate as, let's say, the cash would. No?
What do you mean?
So it's bad to have dollars in your, it's bad to have cash in your hand when you have inflation. Fine, I get that, no? Because what you have in your hand loses value. But what I'm addressing here is not so much, oh, is it good to have something or not to have something? What are the conditions by which, let's say, someone has cash versus having a house? What I'm saying is, if you're trying to store wealth beyond any condition and with duration, what you want is to have something that you can exchange quickly for something else. So liquidity would be the... what I'm saying is that wealth is liquidity.
You're saying like the original meaning of wealth is the ability to get up and leave, so to say. But didn't every nomad have that ability by definition if they were nomads? Oh, that's why they're all wealthy.
It depends on like how good of a nomad you are. Hey, digital nomads, listen to this podcast. Shout out to everybody.
I have two things I want to say. One is not very profound, but it speaks to your point. We just watched the movie Heat, one of the great bank robbery movies of all time.
Boomer, the boomer. He's such a boomer movie. Yeah.
That's a classic. That's a classic.
I'm sorry, Harry, I had to say that. Yeah.
Listen, I come here week after week for the beating I get, and I will continue to be back.
That's the Al Pacino.
Al Pacino,
right?
Robert De Niro. But what De Niro said.
Baseball and shit. Yeah.
But what De Niro said was, you don't have anything in your life that you can't walk away from in 15 minutes or less, meaning stay liquid, be the nomad, right? So that if the heat comes down, whatever the heat may be, you can pick up and walk away. So that's one thought I have. And the other isn't what happened, probably a different podcast, with the economic collapse in this country. And I'm sitting in Vegas right now, 22 of the top 25 zip codes. When the housing market collapsed in 08, we're right here in Vegas. And it was people emulating those who had homes, multiple homes, wanted to put renters in homes. No disrespect, women working in the adult entertainment industry here that got a real estate license that could, everything was based on a signature, stated income. I want to own I want to be a real estate mogul, but I'm at the Spearmint Rhino at night. Emulating what those that were smart with their money that invested in property did. All of a sudden, everybody's emulating that. That's what I want to do. I want to own five rental properties. I want to not work, or I want to be a dancer and make $5,000 a night and have my five rental homes. And it led to the biggest, I know there were other factors, but it led to the biggest economic collapse in our lifetime. And we are at the epicenter of that. Here, where I'm sitting.
Yeah, 100%. Guys.
We're
going to wrap it up today. We've been going for a while, but what a fantastic discussion. We went from Veblen to Springsteen to nomads.
To the Spearmint Rhino.
Yeah. Have a great day, everyone.